This is Mae Warren. I'm in New York City at Columbia University with Professor Robert Paxton. And today is the 18th of April, 1996. This is quite a different place from Washington and Lee. The scale is tremendously different. What's that like for you to come from a small town to Columbia University?
Well, I had some experience as a graduate student in big universities at Oxford and at Harvard, and I had Navy duty in the Pentagon, which is a big organization, in between the MA and the PhD. And I've taught in three big universities. The University of California at Berkeley was much bigger than this. And the new State University of New York, new then, in the 1960s, State University of New York at Stony Brook on Long Island was going to be bigger than this. So this is actually smaller than the other places I've taught. We've got about 14,000 students, about 4,000 undergraduates, but Berkeley had 25,000 undergraduates.
It's all relative.
It's all relative.
I spent yesterday at Princeton, and the scale just keeps getting...
Yeah, well, Princeton is small as universities go, and this isn't huge.
So, you grew up in Lexington.
Yes.
Was it always a given that you'd go to Washington and Lee, or did you ever think of going anywhere else?
I assumed it was a given. My family assumed I would go to Washington and Lee, and so they sent me off to secondary school. And so I had my time away from Lexington. In high school, I went to Exeter in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And everyone at Exeter assumed I would go to Harvard. And they were sort of surprised when I didn't. But I think we all assumed I would go to Washington and Lee like the members of my family had always done. And so that's what I did.
Did you ever consider? Did you think about going other places?
Not seriously at the beginning. I think there was a moment in my sophomore slump when I said maybe I should have stayed in New England or something. Everyone has a sophomore slump. And Dr. Laburn talked me around and said, here's where you ought to be. And he was right.
Tell me more. Tell me why he was right.
Well, I think everyone has a sophomore slump, and there's a lot of work to do, and I was in one of those troughs where you think that you got too many papers and too few close friends, and later on I had many close friends, and that made it okay.
Why was Dr. Laburn right, though? Why was staying at Washington and Lee the right thing to do?
Well, I think that I think that the small class atmosphere and the intimate contact I had with the people I worked with and their very high quality was wonderful for me, because they pushed me very hard and they made me do better. They gave me papers back and made me rewrite them. And they were probably tougher on me than would have been in a big class in a big university.
Really? That's interesting.
They were smart enough to know that I had to be pushed, and they gave me some rigorous criticism.
Now, who were they? Who were these
lots,
faculty
lots
members?
Of people. I had an instructor in economics, Dr. Berman. His nickname was Black Jack Berman. He was a very tough grader. And he would call me in and say, this paper is incoherent. You start with idea A, and you go to idea B, and you come back to idea A. And I would look, and he was right. And it's hard to do that with a class of 60, but you can certainly do it with a class of 20. And he kept me from being complacent. And he wasn't the only one. I remember my freshman year, my English professor, I thought I was going to have an easy semester. And the first paper, he called me in and said, and literally demolished my paper, and he was right.
Who was that?
I'll come up with the name before long. I can't think of it right this second.
Okay.
But I remember the occasion.
You mentioned Dean Labrin.
Mm-hmm.
Was he dean at that point?
Yes.
Was he an important person to you?
Very.
Tell me about him. I'm just beginning to get the story of James Labrin.
I took my learning pretty seriously, and there's the Washington Lee of fraternities and good times, and I had my share of that, and there's the Washington Lee of off-campus activities, and I had my share of that, and then there's the scholarly Washington Lee, and that was important to me because I really wanted a strong academic environment, and Dr. Labrin was the guarantee that that's what I would get. He had been there, I guess, 6 years when I graduated. I think he'd been there maybe 3 years when I came, and he had brought in some very high-quality young faculty, including Berman and a lot of others that I worked with, and there were some that had been there already, like Bill Jenks in history, were there already. But Labrin was the guarantee that we were going to have the best possible faculty and the highest intellectual standards.
Why was he a guarantee?
Well, that was his condition for being there. As long as he was there, he was going to see it was done that way. And he did. And in the most positive kind of way. He brought people there who were fascinating teachers, and he was a fascinating teacher himself, and he made people want to learn. It wasn't done in an authoritarian way, but it was done in a welcoming kind of way. He welcomed you into his style of asking questions in class and examining the presuppositions of of your commonly accepted wisdom, and he impressed everybody with his commitment to not to rote memorization, but to question asking and to probing and trying to get to the bottom of important policy issues, and how to understand your place and your time. He was doing that himself, and he made the rest of us do it.
So you actually took classes from him?
Yeah, I took most of the classes he taught, and he came to Washington Lee in part because he didn't want to teach in one department. He had lots of different courses he wanted to teach. He taught a music appreciation course. He taught a classics and translation course, which I think was the best course I ever took anywhere, including Oxford and Harvard. And then, of course, his field was sociology, and he taught sociology and anthropology, and I took one of those year-long surveys, which was good. I took a lot of different things from him, and when I had a question about something or a problem about my scholarly academic life, I went to see him. He was very accessible. He worked very hard, but he was never inaccessible.
Why was the classics and translation class so spectacular?
Well, I think first of all because he obviously enjoyed it immensely. He was having a ball. He loved this literature, and he managed to transmit that. And secondly, the literature is amazing. I mean, a lot of it would be X-rated nowadays. You know, lots of blood and gore, and sex and violence and so forth. So it's pretty heady stuff. The Greek tragedies and Thucydides and Xenophon and so forth. But he taught in such an illuminating way. It was Socratic. He'd ask you questions. You'd do the reading, and you'd come in, and he would say, now, why is it done this way, and why isn't it done that way? And then he enclosed that in a very informative general framework. He would give us the dates of the author and what was going on at that time in Greek history or Roman history and what the circumstances were. So there was a good solid, sort of rooted solidly. And then he would start asking us what we thought about this and why it was done this way and what the meaning of that term was. And he also made us understand that the problems of translation. He made us do some translations from languages that we knew, like French or Spanish, and he would show what distortions there were in translation, and that we had to understand that the translation was a creation and it wasn't quite the same as the original. So it was a mind opener and an eye opener on a dozen different levels. He couldn't wait to get to class.
He couldn't wait to get to class. Yeah. That's what every teacher would want to hear this student.
Well, yes,
say.
I can't say that for all my classes anywhere, but I'm certain it's not true of my students.
Well, that's an interesting question. A teacher like James Labor, did you then try to take some of his techniques and incorporate it into your teaching?
Well, I can do it in a seminar. We have, Columbia prides itself on having a lot of small classes, and we have lecture courses that might have 100 people in them. It's not that huge, but for history majors, they have to take 2 seminars. So I have these seminars of 15 people, and I do try to do his kind of thing. I insist that they do the reading beforehand, and the whole class consists of asking them what this means and what that means, and what do you think about this, and what do you think about that. And I don't think I have as rich a fund of dynamite questions as Dr. Labor did. But I do think that I make them do the reading. I think I make them think about it. And I am doing what he told me to do. He wasn't the only one. At Exeter, we had only small classes, and he was taught that way. But he did it better than anybody I've had before or since.
I'm sorry I never knew him.
Oh, well, the citizens of Lexington came. Everybody came. Dogs came. It was a great moment.
Yeah, there's a couple of people I've talked to who practically genuflect when they say his name.
Well, there were some people who thought he was too much. I don't know. I've never understood them. He wasn't. He wasn't absolutely 100% idolized. There were some faculty who liked things before he came. And
I understand he actually had a plan that was known as the Labor
Plan.
Yeah,
he had the Labor Plan, and I've never seen a text of the Labor Plan.
Now, were you aware of that as a student?
Not really, no. I was aware of a climate and of a set of expectations that Marshall Lee would be at the very best of the small colleges for its teaching, and what was expected of the students. And that was an atmosphere more than a plan. And I've never seen the text of the plan, and I think that he had to bend to realities. He didn't fire anybody. He would make replacements as vacancies opened up and as the finances permitted. He didn't didn't bring a whole new faculty with him. And there were plenty of good ones there already, and there were some that weren't so good, and he gradually pulled things up.
Were you aware as a student that there were faculty members who weren't supportive of what he was doing?
I think it was after. I was aware when I was a student that there were some students who thought the idolatry had gone too far, and who were more interested in the business school than the arts and humanities, and would dismiss it a bit. But who knew that he was first rate? He wasn't their cup of tea. I heard that once or twice, not very often. And later I learned that there were some faculty who weren't absolutely thrilled with all the new ways and all the new, and perhaps thought he was a little bit too much beloved and I got this. This came along much later. Different faculty.
Well, it seems like what he was trying to do was pretty revolutionary.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah.
And so obviously there were people who'd been there and thought it was fine.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And I think there were probably some people who blamed him for the de-emphasis on sports. So I do not. I'm not privy to those discussions. But I think Dr. Gaines took that decision to stop subsidizing football. But I'm sure Dr. Laban was delighted with that decision. But I do not believe he took it. But I think some people may have blamed him for it. People who thought it was wrong. It was definitely not wrong. Football was bleeding the university white, and it was not fitting in. I've always felt sorriest for the players who thrust into an environment where they're really not quite making it, and forced to provide big time football for a small college. Very, very unfair to them. Anyway, that ended in 53-54. I think some people thought that Dr. Laban was to blame for that, but he wasn't.
Well, that was why I was asking when you graduated, because there was a cheating scandal involved.
Yeah, it was 54. It was not 55. It was 54.
54. Right. Were you there
when all that
happened? Okay, that's what I was hoping.
I was a member of student government. I was.
Please tell me about it. I have not talked to anyone who was student at that time, and I'm very interested to hear.
Well, there was a cheating scandal involving some of the athletes. As I say, were subjected to unfair pressures. They were not quite the work wasn't the academic work wasn't easy for them, and they had less time than the rest of us did. And so some of them found ways of getting copies of the exams. And there was the honor system was enforced by the student government, and we had an honor court. And some of the football players were clearly involved in this theft of exams. And so a lot of the football team had to leave. So the university faced a moment of truth. Either they were going to go out and recruit a whole bunch more semi-professional football players on football scholarships, or they were going to rethink their athletic program. And at that point, Dr. Gaines looked at the balance sheet, and although a lot of alumni gave a lot of money to football, it was draining the university. One of the things that happened was that crew disappeared during those years. It was all swallowed up into the ever-growing financial needs of big-time football. And I think Dr. Gaines and the trustees realized that Washington Lee couldn't afford to play the University of Virginia and Army and teams like that. And it was absurd to try, and it would destroy the university in the process. I think that's what they decided. I obviously wasn't a fly on their wall.
Well, now you were there, though, for dealing with the cheating scandal.
Yes.
How was that handled? There were a lot of people involved.
Yeah, there were a lot of people.
Handle it one by one, each case individually?
Yeah.
That must have taken a lot of time.
It was very painful. There were a lot of sessions that lasted late into the night, and it put the honor system under a great strain, because the honor system has to be consensual, has to be accepted by almost everybody, or it will be mocked and flaunted. And I think it was coming close to the point where people might have said, "Now wait a minute, what is this? One bunch of students expelling another bunch of students over something that's not established in a court of law." But the system was not challenged, and it was accepted by enough people to survive. And Dr. Gaines' decision to stop subsidizing football and to start playing other small colleges and powerhouses was accepted by enough people, though there were a lot of grumbling. Mm-hmm. So it survived. But that was one of the very difficult decisions that Washington Lee presidents have made, and Dr. Gaines made the decision to bring in Dr. Laban and really strengthen the academic environment, and he made the decision to de-emphasize, stop subsidizing football, and those were those were the decisions of a tough, intelligent, far-looking president. I think that Marshall Lee's present strength rests on those two decisions, as well as the co-education decision. And I think those were all part of the tremendous strengthening of Washington Lee that's gone on, that began when Dr. Laverne arrived and has continued. Now makes it one of the best small colleges in the country.
We like to think so. Mm. Tell me about Dr. Gaines. Now, he must have been president, from your perspective as a student, your whole life.
Well, he was a friend of my family, and he was around when I was a child. I think Dr. Gaines came in the middle of the late 30s.
1930, right?
It was 30.
It was 1930.
Well, he came before I was born, so mm-hmm. It was all my life. Mm-hmm. And I saw him at my parents' dinner table through the crack in the kitchen door when I was a child, and I was in some awe of him, and later I knew him better and was more at ease with him. He was a jaunty southern gentleman of the old school who would walk through campus flicking leaves with his cane, with a jaunty Panama hat, a marvelous gift for the right story and a serious point and then a joke. I mean, a wonderful speaker. And a man who could take, and then I learned that he was not just a sort of jaunty, debonair campus leader, but he was a man who could take tough decisions, and he did. So I admired him a lot.
I've listened to some of his speeches, and he really is quite an orator.
Yeah, well, that kind of speech would go over today.
I don't think so, but it's really something to hear it.
Yeah.
And I just imagine he must have been a presence in the whole community.
Oh, he was. He was a personage, and outside the community. I think he was from some boards of maybe the Carnegie Foundation. He certainly had friends in Washington, and was he belonged to something called the Alfalfa Club in Washington, which was senators and mm-hmm. diplomats and things, and they got together for riotous dinners. He was he began the money raising, because Washington Lee had a real money problem
uh-huh.
when I was a child, and the earlier presidents, the son of General Lee wasn't much, and Dr. Denny didn't raise much money, and Dr. Henry Louis Smith didn't raise much money because it was the Depression. Dr. Gaines began raising serious money, the DuPont Hall. He did that part of the job well, too.
You probably have a very kind of unique perspective on all this, considering who your family is in Lexington.
Well, I saw a little bit of behind the scenes. I saw some of these people with their hair down part way. I certainly, the town and the gown sides, I saw both.
Want to talk about that some?
Well, I guess at first I pretended it wasn't so, and I still have some classmates who don't know I was a townie.
Really?
Because my
with
family.
With your name, how could you do that?
Well, they didn't know. They didn't. I mean, my classmates from. Where was I? I think my parents were aware that it was. That there were good ways of being a townie and bad ways of being a townie, and if you didn't handle it right, you would go home from school and never know anybody and never really have campus life. So I lived in the dorm the first year. Mr. Gillum, who was dean of students and who worked very hard to make sure I went to Washington, got me a nice single room with a view of House Mountain and in the dorm, the old dorm. And my parents, of course, I couldn't have a car in those days, but I could borrow the family car, and I saw my parents once a week or so, and we all pretended that I was off at college, because I'd been off at high school, and I joined a fraternity, of course, and I had my lunches there, and I think a lot of people didn't know I was a townie.
Was fraternity life important to you?
Yes and no. I think in those days, when Wash Lee was 90% fraternity, to not be in a fraternity was to be kind of a non-person at Wash Lee. And it's gotten much better. That's one of the things that's improved greatly. You don't have to join a fraternity to have a social life and to know people. But in those days, if you didn't join a fraternity, you were pretty much alone, or a handful of the forgotten ones, and it was a dreadful life. I think that was very bad, and things have been done since to improve that. So I wouldn't have wanted to be at Wash Lee and not be in a fraternity, but I don't think the social life was as important to me as other things. But I think a fair number of people in my fraternity had similar tastes and priorities, and I got along very well with them. I liked them very much.
Another part of growing up in Lexington at the time you did was that the School of Special Services was there during
yes.
World War II.
Yeah.
That must have been you must have been the perfect age to...
Well, I think I was a little young. I was about 10.
Did you go to the shows?
I don't remember going to the shows.
Oh,
I remember some of the classical musicians played. And there were people like Red Skelton, but I don't remember hearing Red Skelton. I don't think I did. I think some of those people went through pretty fast and were
uh-huh.
gone.
Well, it seems like it was such an accelerated program.
Oh, yeah. No, I was only, you know, eight or I was 9 when the war began. I was about 10.
Mm-hmm.
I was 12 when the war was over.
Uh-huh.
So I was really a little young to be.
Yeah, I guess so.
To make a big thing about Red Skelton.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, I wouldn't mind coming back to the fraternity thing.
Oh, please do.
Sooner or later, because I
please do right
to,
now.
To think that as an alumnus, that the steps taken to make life more bearable, actually, for non-fraternity people in the 60s and 70s was a very positive step, and I've been a supporter of years for the plan to have deferred rushing so that people don't arrive green and disoriented and be sort of swept up and that they should join fraternities after they've thought it over and live other ways for a while, because I think there is a danger that the fraternity spirit and the partying side can be all there is. And for some people, it was that way in the early 1950s. I think Wash Lee moved away from that pattern, and I think they should continue to make it possible for a part of the student body to live outside fraternities and have every facility and a rich social life and to feel fully members of the student body. I think they've gone a long way in that direction.
The students are resisting it.
Well, I know. As soon as authority speaks one way, then rebellion speaks the other. But I really didn't like the rushing experience. I thought that was...
Tell me what it was like for you and
well,
why.
I thought that... when I underwent the rushing experience, I was, of course, brand new, and I was bewildered, and I wasn't quite sure what we were really supposed to do, and I thought that it would be better if you were a little older and could judge these matters with a little more distance. And when I was at the giving end, when I was a member, we found ourselves judging the freshmen superficially on their manners and their clothes, and I thought it was training us to make snobbish snap judgments at each other, and I thought it was that those weren't the best values, and they sort of ran against what a good college should do. And so I've taken the opportunity to say, when I've been back on campus and spoken to students, I've usually found a way to say, I hope you find a way to keep Rush Week from shaping your values and putting it in its place. I think it's happening to some.
Well, it is changing, but it's It's meeting resistance, but yeah. I think it will be interesting to see 5 years from now how the Sturgeon students feel about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think so.
They'll probably, whatever the status quo is how it ought to be from the students' point of view. I know your brother went to Washington and Lake.
Yes.
Were you there at the same time?
No.
There was.
No, he graduated in 1948.
Okay.
And there was some war interruption, but he's officially, I think he's, oh dear, is it the class of 47 or the class of 48? I think he graduated in 48, but he might be technically class of 47, delayed by the war.
So there wasn't.
I should know that, and I don't have it at my fingertips.
Yeah, so there wasn't really.
No,
I should know it too. I've interviewed him.
He's 5 years older than I am. Maybe he's in the class, maybe he graduated in 49. But anyway, he was before I came.
Okay, another thing that happened to you, and pretty uniquely to you and a small group of people, was the quiz show?
Quiz Bowl.
Quiz Bowl.
College Quiz Bowl.
Tell me about that.
Well, in those days it was a radio program. This was pre-television. And where it came from, I have no idea, but suddenly one day we learned there was this radio quiz show which pitted four-person teams from one college against four-person teams of another college. And we didn't see each other. It was done with microphones. And we didn't see the moderator, the referee, the MC, who I think was in New York. It was all done by hookup. And he would ask, the moderator would ask a question. And the first person to think he had the idea would push a button, and that gave you the chance to answer. You had to get in first. And then when you, if you answered wrong, you lost your, I'm not sure I have these details exactly right, but then you had a question directed especially to you if you got it right, and otherwise.
You as an individual or your team?
Your team. Uh-huh. But getting gave you an advantage if you answered the first question right, then you got a sort of a free shot. So it was a great advantage to get in early. And I remember that when we got a little overconfident and some of us were pushing the button before we had absolutely sure we had the answer, figuring somebody would have it. But we learned that a lot of the questions came out of Time magazine, so we read Time magazine. And there was a kind of psychic high about it. We learned to dredge our memories pretty fast. We really got it up fast. I think it was probably, that's really not what college is about. They were factual questions. They weren't, it wasn't at all what Dr. Laban meant by education, which is to take unexamined assumptions and examine them. It wasn't that kind of thing at all. We were asked who was the author of this or who the year of that or what is the name of this chemical substance or whatever. But it was, intellectually, it was kind of gathering facts. It was testing of memory. It wasn't really testing intelligence at all, but it was fun.
Had this ever happened at Washington and Lee before?
I don't think it had happened anywhere before. I think it was a new program.
It was new.
And the formula is still around. I think there's a TV program like this mm-hmm. where now you can see each other.
So were you suddenly a celebrity on campus? Was there an audience there while
you
were doing
this? Oh, yeah,
it
was done in Lee Chapel.
Oh, it was?
Oh, yeah. Our team was set up on the stage in Lee Chapel, and everybody came.
Oh, my gosh. This was an event.
And, in fact, one night they asked a question about the Mormons, and I've forgotten the exact question, but the answer was Joseph Smith. And I don't think the question was who was the founder of the Mormons, but it was something like that. And we hesitated, and Dean Gillum, who was the heart and soul of the honor system, who was sitting on the front row, said, "Joseph Smith!" And then he covered up his mouth.
That's great.
But it did, it was a kind of test of memory rather than a test of intelligence. But it was kind of a stunt. But it did draw a big crowd. It filled up Lee Chapel for 6 or 7 weeks running. I think we
won. So it went on week after week?
I think we won 6 times, and then we lost. We finally lost. I think we lost to the University of Pittsburgh. We beat a lot of, we beat Princeton, we beat Smith, we beat a lot of well-known places.
Really?
Because they were all fresh, and we were, you know, by now had momentum. I think it was a bigger thing at Washington Lee than it was at those places. But it drew a crowd. It filled up Lee Chapel for once a week for about 6 weeks.
So were you celebrities? I mean, was it this a big deal?
Well, I don't know. I think I didn't have the sense that we were a great celebrity. I think everyone knew it was a bit of a stunt. Mm-hmm. Well, we earned, I think it was $1,000 a time. Every time we won, it was $1,000 to the university. So everybody was happy.
Well, I bet you were popular with some people.
it was an amusing stunt.
Well, I think it was a unique experience. Did it ever happen again that you know?
Not to my knowledge. I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I don't think so.
Yeah, that's truly why I've been sent here, because you are still a celebrity from that, whether you know it or not. You're the only quiz kid that I know of.
Well, one curious thing about that was there were two townies on the team, Fred Lackman, whose mother ran a private elementary school, private kindergarten in Lexington. And I think Fred lives in Seattle. He's teaching school.
What's his name?
Fred Lackman, L-A-C-H-M-A-N-N. And the other two, one is a history professor at Yale, and the fourth is a nose and throat specialist in Shreveport, Louisiana. But there were two townies.
I think I've actually met that fellow.
Well, Fred doesn't live in Lexington.
No, the other, the Shreveport guy.
Harold Quinn.
I've met him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I met him at a party one time.
Oh, I haven't seen Harold for years. He had a son at college.
Yes. Yeah.
I haven't seen him for many years.
Oh, no, there's a small world. I didn't know he was one of the quiz guys.
Yes, he was a member of the quiz guys.
Huh. Well, tell me about other teachers who were important to you.
Well, Bill Jenks was very important to me because I thought I wanted to be a historian, and he was the main person in European history, and he was a wonderful lecturer, and was not someone brought in by Dean Leyburn, but who taught in ways that made you think about it. He wasn't just imparting information, he was making you examine different interpretations, and he was a very dramatic lecturer. He would wind up the hour with a sort of major point. He would sort of wrap it up with a bang. And long afterwards, I asked him how he somehow managed to come out right on the 50th minute with this sort of whiplash point. He said, "Oh well," he says, "I look at my watch, and if it's time, I drop whatever else I was going to say, and I go to my final point." But it was very effective.
I've heard that about more than one teacher, that they had a tremendous sense of timing.
Yeah.
And they knew how to fill that 50 minutes in a way that was like going to the theater almost.
Yes. Bill Jenks was less of a Socratic teacher in the Leyburn sense, that he was not constantly asking you questions. He had things he wanted to impart in the 50 minutes, and he did it brilliantly. And he was superb at that, at the formal lecture.
So did you concentrate really specifically in history? Or
yeah, I majored in history.
Did you take lots of other kinds of courses? I mean, it sounded like you did.
Yeah. There were various requirements, language, science, math, and so forth. Mm-hmm. I had to fulfill all those breadth requirements, and then I took a certain amount of English, things like that.
You mentioned a music appreciation course.
Yeah.
That was fairly new at that point, bringing in the arts, wasn't it?
No. That was taught in the 40s by John Graham, who was a professor of Spanish and a composer, a townie, but a wonderfully cultivated man, a composer himself. But he taught that course with my brother's time. So it certainly goes back to John Graham in the late 30s. but
I guess my understanding was one of the things that Dean Laburn was trying to do was to bring an emphasis on the arts.
Yeah, he created the department. There was no department. John Graham was in the Spanish department, if I'm not mistaken. And so Dean Laburn founded departments of music and art, and brought in Marianne Junkin in art and in painting, and I took his history of painting. I've got a watercolor of his on my wall up here in New York. And Bob Stewart as the music department. And so that was the beginning of the fine arts as a department. That may have been part of the Laburn plan, for all I know. To strengthen that side of things.
So by the time you were there, those things were in place.
Yeah.
But are you saying that it was a single person for each thing at that point?
I think so. My recollection is that Marianne Junkin was painting, and mm-hmm. Rob Stewart was music. And that was it.
I found a wonderful photograph of an art class, and all the students are standing there in white shirts and ties.
Oh yes,
painting. And I just keep thinking, how did they keep the shirts clean?
I don't think there was any practice in the arts when I was there. Maybe Marianne Junkin had some students. I may be mistaken on that point, but the course I took for him was a history of art appreciation. It's sort of like what Columbia does with the core. We have at Columbia the famous core courses, part of which is art humanities and there's music humanities. Those are required, sort of introduction to the history of the Western musical and artistic tradition and some of the other traditions as well. And that's sort of what these courses were. And I think the practice, the teaching, the practice of the arts came after 54, mm-hmm. although Rob Stewart certainly gave private lessons, and Junkin probably did too.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been instruction, there may have been formal instruction in the practice of the art already. It was just beginning.
You know, probably shifting a little bit now, probably more than most alumni, you have the opportunity to come back very regularly,
yeah,
and see Washington and Lee and the changes that have occurred. And it's dramatically different now.
Mm.
What have you thought as those changes have happened? And
well, I've just been delighted, thrilled. I mean, it means that it's enormously fulfilling to have your college get better and better and better. It's very important for an alumnus to have his college grow in prestige. It's like, in very different terms, like a good investment almost. But it's also personally very satisfying to watch the place develop and enrich and get stronger and meet some of the younger faculty and see how good they are. I very often do some chores in the library when I'm there. The library is quite extraordinary.
It's really amazing for the town,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Oh, yeah. So it's been, every alumnus has nothing but has everything to gain when his college strengthens. But I'm especially pleased with it because I have known a certain number of faculty members. I guess I know fewer than that.
I need to turn the tape over. I just have a couple more questions.